Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with North Carolina State Professor Dr. Michael Schwalbe about his book, Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. And I know this is a subject that's near and dear to you with your work, Adam. Looking forward to meeting with him.
Well, I think it's near and dear about tobacco-related diseases to virtually everyone in the state
sure
of North
is.
Carolina and around the United States. And I think that's something we'll talk about with Michael today. But first, Christy, we've actually got some really interesting research about things that have been in the news and some things that haven't been in the news relating to supplements with selenium, supplements for the drug called Celebrex.
A little bit about trying to prevent Alzheimer's and about head injury for children.
And probably also for adults, because I did have a head injury myself a year or two ago. Maybe we'll bring that up. But first off, let's talk about this research that was in a publication called the Cochrane Library about selenium. First off, what is the Cochrane Library, Christy?
So the Cochrane Library is this really wonderful group that will summarize research in a really good way and look systematically to see and answer questions that are relevant to people.
So this isn't a library you go to like the public library in New York, but you can go online and look at it. And we'll put a link online to the Cochrane Library because it has great reviews about a whole host of issues, including this particular one about selenium in cancer. Is that an important research?
Well, it is. How many of you out there take selenium either in your multivitamin or take it to try to prevent cancer? Apparently, a lot of people do. And this is a study looking to see if it makes any difference to try to prevent cancer.
Yeah. And the reason is that in earlier studies, what are called observational studies, where we look in large groups of people, people who had a low selenium diet had higher rates of cancer. So the hypothesis was that we should have people take selenium supplements and that would lower rates of cancer. And then they designed these really good trials called randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, the gold standard of good research.
And those are the studies that we trust the most. And in the studies they looked at, people were assigned to take the selenium supplements at doses at least four times or higher than what most people would get in their diet or who are recommended in their diet. And in the studies, they were not less likely to get cancer. So there was no real good evidence looking at these that taking selenium is at all beneficial to prevent cancer.
And then if you do what the Cochrane Library did, which is to put these all together into this systematic review, the answer is pretty conclusive. Doesn't prevent a cancer, certainly in the doses and the length of time they've looked at, which to me says doesn't work. Don't spend your money on it. Even though it's a couple dollars a month, I wouldn't be recommending this for my patients. What about you, Christy?
I am not either.
Okay. We come to agreement on this particular one.
Selenium does not prevent cancer.
Okay. Well, we have this next one here, this next research, interesting research about a drug called Celebrex, which a lot of people may have heard of, and colon cancer. This one's not obvious on the surface.
Well, it's a little more confusing because Celebrex, which is a type of medicine that people use for anti-inflammatory, for their joint pains, in the class of COX-2 inhibitors is the fancy name for them.
Including the one that was banned off the market called Vioxx, which was made by Merck, got eliminated from the market. So this is one of the few ones that's still remaining.
And so, you know, these were brought into question a couple years ago because of evidence showing an increased risk of heart disease.
But now there's also they found out that they may cut the risk of colon cancer. So this is research that actually is published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology to look at, indeed, does taking this medication called Celebrex lead to less polyps of the colon? And if so, is that something then that we should recommend people to take? Or are we worried about that there is a higher risk of heart disease like was found in some of the older COX-2 inhibitors.
And so in this study, they looked at over 1,500 people who already had a history of colorectal cancer or at higher risk for having colorectal polyps and cancer. And some of them had received the Celebrex for 3 years. And then when the studies came out about the heart disease risk being higher, they gave them the option to continue on the medicine or to drop out of the studies.
Yeah, and one of the things they found, which I think is receiving the attention, is that this taking of the Celebrex did lead to less polyps. Though it wasn't – I expected this was going to be an overwhelming slam dunk, Christy, that there were, you know, hundreds of, you know, thousands or just, you know, that's a very, very large number. And it wasn't as much as I thought it was going to be. And the thing that was even more concerning to me is, yes, they had less polyps, so presumably they would have less cancer, but they actually also had a lot more heart problems, and that was concerning to me.
They sure did. So, I mean, I think the take home from this is that, first of all, you should weigh the risks and the benefits with your physician for you, because it is confusing, but that these COX-2 inhibitors, or Celebrex in particular, does raise your risk of heart disease.
66% higher risk of serious heart disease versus these polyps. Yes, it's important. And maybe if you have a really strong family history of colon cancer, you might want to talk to your doctor about it. But heart disease is a lot more common than colon cancer.
I completely agree with you. The next one is about trying to prevent Alzheimer's. And this is something
for me, that's important.
For all of us, that is important. And there have been lots of studies kind of looking at diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking, possibly raising the risk of Alzheimer's, and other studies showing maybe diet and other things could try to keep the brain healthy and maybe lower the risk. And so we're trying to tease this out with the study.
Yeah, and we will continue to bring – this is one of a series of updates from the National Institute of Health about Alzheimer's in kind of summarizing the current status of diet. And unfortunately, in this particular case, there isn't enough known really about the great research that's followed enough people for a long enough period of time to say conclusively that following a more plant-based and less animal-based diet can cut your risk. But it seems like there's no downside to recommending that, particularly if you've got a family history of Alzheimer's.
I don't think there's downside because there are other health benefits. But, I mean, unfortunately, we're looking for that thing that you can alter in your life to prevent Alzheimer's. And we really, according to this group of experts really summarizing the evidence, we really don't have one. You got old age, you've got genetic factors, and those are two things you can't do a whole lot about. So we need to study this. I mean, it's obviously very, very important.
And we hope that there will be money put into this because it's not a drug here that may be altering this Alzheimer's. There are drugs, but here we're talking about some diet and lifestyle modifications, certainly quitting smoking. And we'll talk about that with our guest, Michael Schwalbe, in just a few minutes. What about our very last research that matters, Christy?
And the last one's about concussions or head injuries. We all know that there's a lot of concern in the news about getting CAT scans and x-rays and radiation over time if you keep getting these studies. And so this is a question about whether or not all kids need CAT scans when they get a head injury.
Yeah, and so in this particular research, which was published in the journal Pediatrics, appropriately enough, a group of researchers looked at 40,000 kids who had had a head injury who were taken to 25 different emergency rooms, and how many of them got x-rays or CAT scans versus how many got observed. And then among those kids who got observed but didn't get immediate x-rays, how many of those ended up needing CAT scans and had serious conditions?
Well, it's really tricky because the CAT scans are kind of ruling out a major fracture of your skull or a bleed in the brain, but it doesn't necessarily diagnose the concussion, which is what a lot of, I think, parents and physicians are trying to reassure or answer that question. It really has to do with signs and symptoms and severity of what happened.
Right, and it turns out that about one out of three children who have a head injury end up getting a CAT scan. And even in the group that was initially delayed, about one out of three of them ended up going on and getting an x-ray. So it's a CAT scan. So it's clear that not every child needs a CAT scan. And it looks like doctors are doing a pretty good job right now of at least trying to pick out the ones that need it and don't need it. But the problem is that even if only one out of 100 has a serious enough injury that picks up a fractured skull or a bleed, I don't know what the right number here, Christy. Would that be enough to dissuade you as a mother not to get your CAT scan for your child? If I said 99 times out of 100, you don't need it, or if I said 1 out of 100 times, this could save your child, which would you choose?
Well, it's not that – I hope it's not that black and white. I think it has to do with the severity of a patient's symptoms and what exactly happened. And so, I think that this research team's conclusions that observation might be appropriate for some kids is a way to try to cut down on that radiation overall.
Yeah. Well, I did not have a CAT scan initially when I had my head injury, but several weeks to months later, I ended up getting it because of continuing headaches. And, of course, the good thing is I did not have a serious injury. So it's a hard question. It's personal, and I know a lot of parents struggle with it. But that's going to conclude our Research That Matters today. We've had a chance to talk about head injuries and Alzheimer's.
A little bit about Celebrex and colon cancer.
And selenium. We don't recommend it for cancer prevention.
So we are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Michael Schwalbe about his book, Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with NC State Department of Sociology and Anthropology Professor Dr. Michael Schwalbe about his new book, Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. And it's really a pleasure to have Dr. Schwalbe on our show today, because not only is tobacco an issue that is in the lives of virtually everyone in North Carolina and outside the state in one way or another, because we all have stories of how it's affected us, for a lot of us negatively through health, but some people economically otherwise. And Dr. Schwalbe, thank you so much for coming here today to bring to us a book that looks to capture some of this impact that tobacco has, and in this case, really predominantly the negative impact, not only for people in North Carolina, but around the world. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks again for being with us. I was really struck looking at your book at the decision and the approach that you took. So, we hear the statistics. I think everybody knows tobacco is bad for you. You hear these astounding statistics with 440,000 deaths in the United States each year. What is it, 6 million globally that die from tobacco? And yet, it doesn't seem to really hold root for everyone in the same way that personal stories capture people. Tell us about your decision to write the book and to approach it through personal stories and photographs.
Well, the inspiration for the story was watching my father. I was watching my mother deal with my father as he was dying of lung cancer. And this would have been 1996, 97, and into the spring of 1998. And as I was watching his decline and watching her care for him, it occurred to me that this was part of the hidden story. It was the people who have to deal with someone sick and dying and in terrible decline and losing someone. So when we say 440,000 people die every year from tobacco-related disease in the United States, what we don't usually think about are all the people connected to those who are dying. Mm-hmm. And so watching what my mother was dealing with over this year and a half period of surgery, chemo, radiation, and watching her deal with my father, who was not an easy man even when he was well, led me to think that this is an important part of the story to document the hidden phase of tobacco-related disease.
Well, you have been an advocate. We know each other through this work in the tobacco field, and you've been an advocate here in North Carolina for as long as I can remember here in North Carolina as well. And I assume some of this advocacy stems from this exposure, but your exposure was also, you had other family members also. You describe in your book this very personal exposure to not just your father, which would be, as we would say, bad enough, but there were other family members as well that seemed to have this to be a family experience for you.
Yeah, it was a family experience in strange ways, going back to childhood. As I say in the book, there's a short piece that's kind of my tobacco memoir. one of my first acts of civil disobedience, I suppose you could call it, was when I was 11 years old and I refused to go to the drugstore and get cigarettes for my mother on the grounds that it was bad for her and she shouldn't enlist me in causing that harm. So even as a young person, I knew that there was a problem with smoking and tobacco use. And the adults in my family admitted it to the extent they were willing. And so even early on, I knew this was kind of an issue. It was sort of a justice issue for me in a way as a young person. I also saw earlier in the 90s, my grandmother developed a tumor based on exposure to secondhand smoke. I had uncles and aunts who'd suffered other kinds of health problems, heart disease, atherosclerosis. And it's something I'd cared about for a long time, even before I started doing this book. So it wasn't just watching my father's situation. It was watching what tobacco had done to my family over the course of many years.
Well, one thing I know from some work that I've done is that if you go into a room of people in this state and around the country and you say, how many of you have a close personal friend or family member who's died from tobacco, at least one out of two hands goes up. And there's no other disease that I know of. You know, you say, how many of you have had someone that's died of diabetes? You might have one out of seven. But here in tobacco, and you talk about this in your book, it affects so many people. How did you begin to put your arms around the type of book that you were going to do?
Well, as I say, I originally thought of documenting the experience of people I was calling tobacco widows, people, and I was speaking metaphorically, people who'd lost friends or family members to tobacco-related disease. And then as I thought more about it, I realized that there are so many other people in our society who are affected in one way or another, not just as survivors or widows, but also as educators and activists, legislators, litigators, researchers, caregivers, and even here in North Carolina, some ex-tobacco farmers, people who got out of growing the crop because of concern about its health effects. But what was interesting is when I started the book, I thought I could keep those categories fairly clear. But as I went on and I interviewed people in the researcher, activist, educator, litigator, lawyer categories, they all had somebody in their family who'd suffered from tobacco-related disease, almost without exception. That category, the category of tobacco widow, could have subsumed all the others.
Well, and seeing the beautiful photography in this picture, I mean, in the book, coupled with the stories, very simple stories in terms of length and information about each person, but really captures the heart of what they've struggled with or their history. I found it like something that's an ugly, ugly topic, something that we might shake our finger at people. You need to stop smoking. It was strangely beautiful because it captures the real struggle for a lot of people who may not have a voice. They're not the ones saying, oh, you should quit. They've been suffering and tried. I was really struck by the story with Fred Haywood. Could you share with us a little bit about the story of Fred Haywood, which is coupled beside this beautiful picture of him and his motorcycle?
Yeah, Fred. Let me just tell you a little bit about him. He was just 36 when he was diagnosed with throat cancer in 1990. He was someone who'd started smoking late. He was 18, and he started smoking while he was working construction. He told me it was kind of a break time thing. He'd go and hang out and try to be one of the guys. So he started smoking at that age. He ended up having surgery to remove his larynx, and then 35 radiation treatments following that.
Wow.
Yeah, and it took him a year to be able to learn to speak again. Had to use a special kind of voice prosthesis to be able to speak. And now he's doing cancer counseling with our patients at, I think it's Winston-Salem.
Cancer Hospital.
Cancer Hospital, yes.
Well, and you included in the book some of his comments about right after surgery, that urge to have another cigarette and this interaction with the nurse. I thought was beautiful. Would you read that?
Yes, this is Fred speaking. It's his voice. It'll be my voice on air. It'll be his voice coming out of the text. This is what Fred told me in the interview. About 5 nights after the surgery, I went to the nurse's station and asked for a cigarette. The nurse said, come here, honey. I want to show you something. She took me to a mirror, first time I'd seen myself after the surgery, and I looked bad. She said, are you sure you want a cigarette? I had a craving like you couldn't believe, and I just kept nodding my head and saying, please, please, please. She said, okay, and she went to her purse. And then she sat me down in the nurse's station, gave me the cigarette and lit it, and she said, go ahead, puff. And I didn't know you can't puff because you don't breathe through your mouth no more. You breathe through the stoma. So the stupid cigarette wouldn't light, and I started getting upset with her. And she says, if you want that cigarette so bad, you've got to put it over there, over the stoma. I just gave her back the cigarette. I was not about to stick a cigarette in my stoma. To smoke from there? I felt lucky to be alive. I wasn't even supposed to be alive. How stupid would I be to put a cigarette there?
Just wow. That he shared that going from there to then going on and counseling people about quitting smoking is just so remarkable.
There are a number of people like Fred in the book who had experiences like that, and they decided that they wanted to make something of their experience and turn around and try to help others.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but we'll return talking with our guest, Dr. Michael Schwalbe, about his new book, Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of Americans' Tobacco's Wars. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with North Carolina State Professor Dr. Michael Schwalbe about his book, Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. And you are sharing, Dr. Schwalbe, about one of the people who shared their story in your book, Fred Haywood. And I appreciate you reading some of that in the last segment. And the other person that really jumped out when I first looked at this is Rena Roberts, because she does those commercials for anti-tobacco that really reaches kids in our state.
Yeah. I think Rena came to my attention through SAVE.
SAVE is the Survivors and Victims of Tobacco Empowerment Project.
Yes, and Catherine Hampton, who's head of that, was instrumental in putting me in touch with a number of people, and she put me in touch with Rena Roberts. And I think what's interesting there is the young age at which she experienced cancer. And I wanted to have her in the book to make that point that tobacco-related disease isn't necessarily something that's going to hit everyone in their 50s or 60s. She was 20.
Yeah, and that whole Tobacco Reality Unfiltered campaign that North Carolina does is based on the real stories that you actually capture in the book. One thing I'm struck by, though, in your book, and Christy alluded to it previously, is the photography. Tell us a little bit about the photography, because you look at the pictures of Rena on the TV, and she is a very attractive, striking woman, but on the TV you also are exposed to the laryngectomy. Mm-hmm. In your pictures, you do see much more, not genteel, but they're very striking, and I know that's purposeful. Help us understand the photography, because I think it's beautiful.
What I was trying to do with all of the people was to show readers of the book what these people looked like in their everyday lives, not necessarily when they were sort of in a special mode of self-presentation, either as teachers or people appearing in a video on television, but rather photographing them at their homes, in their workplaces, just looking like they normally do. But also in each case, there's something that shows the person's connection to tobacco-related disease. So in the case of Rena's photograph, you can see the electrolarynx, and if you look closely, you can see the stoma.
Mm-hmm. And you also made the decision to do it all in black and white, which it feels like that makes sense, but articulate that for me.
Yeah, as a photographer, I see black and white as a medium that abstracts what's general from the photographs. So there are 46 people in the book, and I originally began thinking I would do 44, each person standing for 10,000 who die every mm-hmm. year in the United States from tobacco-related disease. So the number was sort of arbitrary, but not arbitrary. And I thought, to make that point about the each person representing a reality that's not there but that exists in the statistics and, of course, exists in the real world, that black and white would do a better job of bringing that out, of showing the general principle as opposed to some of the distractions that you get with color photographs.
You know, one of the things that you talk about black and white is the good guys and the bad guys, and that it's so clear, and you talk about in your foreword that the industry doing criminal and irresponsible behavior And in the book, you interview two, I think, figures. One, a North Carolina state legislator, Hugh Holloman, and the other is a former tobacco industry lobbyist, Jeffrey Wyken. Can you tell us a little bit about those two interviews and the figures and why you included them in your book?
Well, Hugh Holloman is sort of a hero to those of us in tobacco control in North Carolina for his efforts that extended over a multi-year period to try to get a smoke-free air law passed in North Carolina. Also was a survivor himself.
Had lung cancer.
Lung cancer. And a sister who died of lung cancer. And he attributes both to the secondhand smoke exposure that they experienced growing up in a smoke-filled household with their parents. Representative Holloman was, I think, a champion and really persisted in this in the belly of the beast, so to speak, here in North Carolina. So I wanted to get him in the book. I think it was important to show legislators who have that kind of courage and tenacity and maybe to serve as a model for legislators elsewhere. And you mentioned Jeffrey Wyken. He was head of research at Brown & Williamson. Tobacco company, yes. I don't think he ever did any lobbying for them that I'm aware of. He was actually a famous whistleblower, I guess you could say, as famous as any whistleblower can be. Russell Crowe played him in the 1999 film The Insider. Uh-huh. So if anyone is interested in knowing more about Jeffrey Wyken's story, they can get that from Netflix or somewhere else and watch
that. It's a great
movie. Yeah, it shows what he went through as a whistleblower, the pressure he was under and some of the risks that his family faced because of that. And he continues to do tobacco control work. And I think part of his mission in life now, as he told me in a very long interview, was to be a thorn in the side of the tobacco industry.
Well, you share these stories of some real heroes, and I know the two of you are heroes in this work in North Carolina. And yet you also speak in the introduction about this being really a profitable epidemic and raise the questions of is this a problem behind us? Are we starting to really make headway? What do you say about that in your book, or what's your take on that?
Well, we certainly have made headway, depending on your point of comparison. If you compare smoking rates, say, from the 1960s to today, we've roughly cut the rate in half. We're hovering around 20% right now in the U.S. among the adult population. So we've made good progress. I think that's clear in North America and in Western Europe. But the problem is certainly not behind us. If we take a larger look, if we look at select populations in the United States, lower-income people, people with less education, certainly the problem is starting to concentrate as a social class problem in the United States. And if you look globally around the world, it's quite possible that the worst is yet to come. If you're looking at what tobacco industries are doing and at tobacco consumption around the world, especially in less developed countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, China, and perhaps also in Africa now.
You have, you know, what is your, you know, hope? I mean, you know, you have collected here stories from survivors to those who have been advocating for change. You've got this incredible documentary and with pictures. Would you hope in the next 5 years that people do with this book? Who do you want to have it, and what do you want them to do with it?
Well, I can imagine multiple audiences, and I think that people who may be moved by what they see in the book, both by the essays and information and the photographs and the testimony of the people, may want to keep pressure, for instance, on their representatives to continue to do the kinds of things we know work. We need higher taxes on tobacco products. We need comprehensive advertising bans. We need smoke-free air laws that cover workplaces as well as bars and restaurants. And we need continuing funding for education and for cessation. All that needs to continue being done, as I think you've probably said a number of times on this show, and it's a point well worth emphasizing. The issue needs to be on the front stage, and people need to continue to take it seriously and bring pressure to bear to see that those kinds of policies are pursued and pursued even more aggressively, because the industry is always there to resist and to find ways around whatever else we do. So I'm hoping that that kind of response will make a difference. And maybe in the hands of some people, this book will encourage them to quit smoking.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. I would love to have this book to be able to share with some of my patients who may be considering but, you know, are struggling with that strength and the decision and all the factors, to be able to really see the beauty of these stories and the power that comes with people really advocating for change.
Well, when people speak about their personal experience, too, struggling with tobacco addiction, maybe that'll resonate with some people who are still using tobacco and are still addicted but just need to firm up their resolve to quit. And I think sometimes hearing that from a physician is, sorry to say, less moving than hearing it from someone else
Absolutely.
Who's struggled and overcome.
Absolutely. Where can our listeners get their hands on this book?
Amazon.com is probably the quickest way to do it. I don't know for sure where it's available over the counter, but it's Borderland Books, distributed by University of Wisconsin Press. And there's, as I say, Amazon's probably the quickest, easiest way.
Well, we've been talking with NC State professor Dr. Michael Schwalbe about his book, Smoke Damage. And Michael, thank you for joining us. I think that we have contributions to make to making a smoke-free world. I think this book is a powerful contribution to that environment. And thank you for the time and effort that you've put into it for our listeners.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, we're going to talk for a few minutes about your health questions and concerns.
You know, Christy, we've had a great opportunity already to talk about important research that matters relating to vitamins, supplements, and lots of other things, and hear about smoke relations with Professor Schwalbe. And now we're going to hear about questions from our listeners about things about blood type and IUDs, two different questions. And what else?
About stress tests and about brittle nails.
So we're going to go from, I guess, from the top to the bottom here. But let's talk about the very first house call that we have today that comes from a listener about blood type. Let's take a listen to it.
I get blood regularly. I'm told I'm O negative, and that's really great. What does that mean?
That is a great question, and congratulations for having this wonderful blood. I'm glad everyone's been complimenting you on your wonderful blood because you are a universal donor.
And in contrast to you being an O negative, which means your blood can be given to just about anyone, I am an A negative, which means that I can only really give to those people who have blood types like me.
I'm one of the special ones. I'm O negative, which makes me feel happy.
You're like our listener.
I am. But, and there's other good news, and that is that there is a blood drive coming up on June 7th. And if you want to give your blood and to make a contribution in that way, you can go to www.unc.edu/blood or just Google blood drive June 7th, Carolina, and you'll find it.
Yeah, so in general, if you you really have to get blood from either, you know, your specific type or this O type, that will not be a problem for you in terms of the antibodies or the cross reactivity for it. But that doesn't mean that, let's say, I'm A negative, that I shouldn't be giving blood, because, you know, a lot of people really need blood that's A, and the negative is the type of a reaction that you might have when exposed to a specific type of antigen or irritant.
So please do look into giving blood. It's something that, you know, if you are civic-minded or you are the type of person who wants to make a contribution, this is one that doesn't cost you money. And your body will build up your blood back, and it's such a wonderful thing you can do for people.
And we'll put up a short little note on our website about the different types of blood products. Let's listen now, Christy, to our very next house call from a listener asking about cardiac stress tests.
My cardiologist has talked about doing a nuclear stress test. So what's the difference between a nuclear stress test and a regular stress test?
That is an important question, and it's one, you know, it gets a little bit confusing. So, Adam, let's try to sort of explain the basic differences between what people consider a regular stress test, which is usually a treadmill stress test, versus one of these nuclear stress tests.
Or one that involves what's called a radionuclide, something that's injected in a tracer that helps actually raise your heart rate chemically in most circumstances versus the treadmill, where you have to get up on that treadmill and you have to raise it yourself by exercise. And so there are certain people who can't do a regular treadmill. Who can't do a regular treadmill, Christy?
Well, someone who can't walk well.
Someone who has arthritis of the knees, mm-hmm. or rheumatoid arthritis.
Or someone who is so badly deconditioned that they really can't walk fast enough to really get their heart rate up for a long enough time to be able to either watch those EKG tracings that we do on a treadmill's test, or in some cases we'll look with an ultrasound at the heart while you're on a treadmill. And if you can't be on there for very long, then it's really not a good test.
Some people have underlying lung disease or heart disease that, again, could limit it. So those are the people who would go to then this nuclear stress test, which can, through injection of different chemicals, it can raise the heart rate, and then you can see how the oxygen level happens with the raised heart rate.
Most people don't really enjoy the experience because you get this medicine in your arm and then all of a sudden you feel flushed sometimes and your heart's
running really faster than you really want it to go.
But it does offer the heart doctor some really good pictures and information about whether or not you have blockages to your heart. So it can be very helpful.
And the question is, why wouldn't we all want that nuclear stress test?
Well, why not, it's very, very expensive. The other, I think
like
it's
10 times more expensive than a regular treadmill.
But I think it's important to say that both the treadmill stress test and the nuclear stress test give us information, but it's all guessing at what the true information you can get by having a cardiac catheterization, which is where they put dye in and actually look at your blood vessels to see if there are blockages. But that is invasive and costs more money and can be dangerous if you don't need it.
But if you can walk on a treadmill and you don't have these underlying diseases, it's a good test, and it'll be just as sensitive for most people in picking up the underlying possible reasons why you would have to have a cardiac catheterization. So hopefully that's helpful. Let's go to the very next house call, which is actually one that came in to us on Twitter. Why don't you read it, Christy?
Okay. One person writes, "My nails are very brittle and break often, and they also tend to get white spots on them. Does this mean I'm deficient in some vitamin? If not, what can I do, or is there something I can take to help build my nail strength?"
Good question. I hope our answer is as good as the question. And there's lots of pieces to this answer, which means that there are problems with the nails are, boy, they're frequent, and there's lots of different diseases that can cause problems with the nails.
I mean, there are many diseases in the body, as you're saying, Adam, everything from thyroid problems to other like inflammatory processes.
Psoriasis
in your body
can cause all kinds of white spots on the nails. Fungal infections can cause white spots on the nails.
And then there are other things like just your genes, like just the way your family makes their fingernails or picking at your nails.
Yeah, some people pick at. Some people actually do have nutritional deficiencies, particularly iron or trace minerals. So lots of reasons why they can happen, most of which you probably are going to have to see someone who knows a little bit about nails. So this is a hard one for us to diagnose over our show.
Well, and I'd love to see it. You know, we have pictures worth
a
thousand. Yeah, send us a picture and some more information.
Of the little white spots on your nails there. But we will post some information about nail, and maybe we can even put some pictures up on our website of maybe not your nails, but other people's nails and what we found.
That'd be great. Let's do our next question. It's about IUDs, which is something that it's a procedure I place often in clinics. So I'm excited to hear the question. Adam, will you read it?
Yeah, this came in from a listener through the email, and it says, "My friend is interested in getting an IUD, but is anxious because she's heard a lot of stories about how painful it is when inserted and that it can fall out. How common are these problems with IUDs, and is it still worth it?" What do you think, Christy?
Well, it's a great question, and I would say, you know, to ask how painful it is when it's inserted, it can cause some cramping. Usually, people tolerate it really well. We usually give people 800 milligrams of Motrin beforehand, so a little ibuprofen to help with that cramping. People tolerate it very well. Falling out has happened, and I'm sure you've heard stories about this, but it's not very common as long as we're not putting it in right after you just had your baby. If you've had a baby and we put it in right after delivery, then it's more likely to fall out. But if you give it some time for your cervix to close and get a little closer to normal, then it's really not very common for it to fall out.
So if you have an IUD, the right person, the right place, the right product, And at the right price, it's an okay thing to do.
Oh, my goodness. It's convenient. You don't have to remember to take a pill every day. You only have to replace it every 5 or every 10 years, depending on which one you choose. It works really well, and it can be placed in the office. So
we need a male IUD.
I promote it.
We need
it.
A
yeah.
male IUD, Christy.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's going to conclude our house calls today. But we've had a chance not only to talk about IUDs, but about brittle nails.
And a little bit about stress tests.
And blood types. So thank you for joining us on Your Health. Please send us your own questions and stories at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 966-8081.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and now on iTunes for free podcasts. And we want you to interact with us, so please write us.
We want to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, NC State Professor Dr. Michael Schwabe.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL. 1360 WCHL wants to connect with you online for updates on our lifestyle programs, awesome giveaways, contests, trivia, community photos, breaking news, and more. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/chapelboro and become our fan on Facebook, and always connect with us online at chapelboro.com.